Eric Liddell. Eric Liddell was a Scottish track star. He represented Great Britain in the 1924 Summer Olympics in Paris. He was the British record holder in the 100-meter dash. That was his specialty, although he ran other races. He had the British record of 9.7 seconds at that time, and he was favored to win the Olympics. However, one of the preliminary heats was held at the Olympic Games was held on a Sunday, and so because of his beliefs, he believed he could not run on a Sunday, so he withdrew himself from the race, a race, again, he was expected to win. He believed, by the way, that Sunday was the equivalent, was the Christian equivalent of the Sabbath, and he believed that you were not to do any kind of work on the Christian Sabbath, so he could not compete. Now, later in the Olympics, he did compete in the 400-meter race, which he won. He set an Olympic and world record of 42.6 seconds that record held for another 12 years. And he won a bronze medal in the 200. You may be familiar with the name because if you ever saw the movie Chariots of Fire, the story was about him. Liddell demonstrated a character quality that I think is so important, and unfortunately it's awfully rare in a lot of circumstances. He demonstrated integrity. Integrity is at the intersection of our beliefs and actions. And the fonts are messed up. Anyway, that does say integrity, and action is supposed to be one word. But anyway, integrity comes together when we say, this is what I believe, and then we match it up with what we do. A lot of people say they believe this, and then they act in ways that are totally inconsistent with what they say they believe. Integrity is part of what helps us bring those two things together in the proper way. They bring things together in the right way. If you look up the word integrity in various dictionaries, integrity is the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles. It is moral uprightness. It's the state of being whole and undivided, the condition of being unified, unimpaired, or sound in construction. If you look at the word integrity, it's related to the math concept of an integer. An integer is a whole number, a number that is not a fraction. It represents something that is complete in itself. I remember in engineering school, we talked a lot about integrity in structural terms. If a bridge or a building has been damaged in some way, you want to know if the thing still has its integrity, whether the thing will hold together or not, whether it stands as a unit or not. So that's the concept of integrity. So I want us to talk this morning about the biblical concept of integrity and talk about how we know whether we have it or not. Psalm 15, in the opening verses, Psalm 15 is, it asks the question, who's qualified to dwell on the holy hill of God? It's a psalm of David, and he says in the opening verses, O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? And then the answer comes back in the remaining verses, in verses 2 through 5, here's the person who is qualified to stand before God, he who walks blamelessly and does what is upright and speaks truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. Now, this psalm talks a whole lot more about things other than integrity, but integrity is what it deals with in verse 2. He who walks blamelessly. And the word blamelessly here, it can be translated as he who walks in his integrity. It's related to the concept of truth. There's actually a number of biblical words. If you look in the Bible, it can carry the connotation of integrity. Truthfulness, faithfulness, sincerity. There in Psalm 15, verse 2, again, that's the English Standard Version, the one who walks blamelessly. Turn over to Genesis chapter 20. Here's another word that can be used. Genesis chapter 20. This is when Abraham sojourns down into a place called Gerar. There was famine in the land, and so he travels a little bit further south than where he's been. He tells Sarah to lie about her identity, to identify herself as his sister. Technically, they were stepbrother and stepsister, but they were also married. And if you'll remember, Abimelech, who's the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. He intended to take her as wife. But God came to Abimelech, this is verse 3 of Genesis 20. God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her, and so he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said that he is my brother? In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." He said, "I honestly did not know that they were lying. I had no idea." He's protesting on the basis of his integrity. Another set of words, both in the Old and New Testament, are words related to truth. And often the idea of truthfulness has to do with integrity. In the New Testament more, you see the word faith or faithfulness. That can carry the connotation of integrity as well. Sometimes it's the idea of sincerity. Sometimes it's the idea of being genuine inside and out. A few New Testament passages that lean this way, for instance, in Matthew chapter 23, when Jesus is denouncing the hypocrisy of the scribes and Pharisees, he says in verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness." That word faithfulness is related to the word faith in the New Testament. But in this particular case, it's the idea of steadfastness, and there's an element there of sincerity and integrity to that word as well. In Romans 12, down in verse 9. "Let love be genuine." Some translations say, "Let it be unfeigned." There's no fake to it. It's sincere. This is genuinely how you feel toward someone else. It's genuinely how you look at someone else. And so all of these words, again, can be used in different shades of meaning, but they all come back to the idea of integrity, sincerity, truthfulness, without any degree of hypocrisy whatsoever. So that's what all of these words, how all these words relate to the concept of integrity. Someone has said that integrity is like the difference between a hollow core door and a solid door. They both look the same, they both function the same, but one of them has substance and the other one doesn't. I've had hollow core doors in a lot of my houses. And I remember our son going through one of them one time. Didn't have a whole lot of integrity to it. Didn't have a whole lot of substance to it. If you've ever had to try to repair a hollow core door, good luck with that. A solid door, it has substance to it. It has integrity to it. So that's kind of the idea behind this word. And I want to spend the rest of our time talking about how you test integrity. How do you know if you have integrity? And I want to propose 7 tests of integrity. Number 1, the Hulk test. Now, you remember the story of the Hulk, David Banner? He was this guy who spent way too much time in a lab, and because of an experiment gone awry, he could magically transform himself into this green, huge, hulking, angry beast. And what it does, the question is, when you're stressed, when something upsets you, do you become a different person? I think that's a matter of integrity. Some people are wonderful people as long as everything is going well. And the moment something goes bad, they become totally different people. They can become foul-mouthed. They can become angry. They become irritable. Some people, that happens when you sit in their pew, but that's another sermon. When something stresses you, when something upsets you, are you just a totally different person because of that? I think about David and his sin with Bathsheba. Everything we see about David up to 1 Samuel chapter 11, David's a great guy. And he has actually withstood a lot of tests of his character, mainly from King Saul. King Saul was one of these guys. He was a wonderful fellow up until David got around. And when Saul heard people singing about Saul has killed his thousands, David has killed his 10,000s, boy, that just set him off. And anytime David shows up, Saul suddenly becomes, well, irritable. And he tries to kill him time after time after time. David has his own issue around Bathsheba. He just accidentally sees her bathing on the rooftop. He could have let it go there, but he didn't. He inquires further. He brings her into the royal palace. They commit adultery, and then the cover-up begins. Prior to 1 Samuel 11, would you ever have expected that of someone like David? No. He's the one who is the man after God's own heart. He's the one who's a far better king than Saul ever could have been. And yet, in a moment of weakness, he loses his integrity. He loses his sincerity, his honesty, his truthfulness. The whole cover-up, and we're not going to take the time to read 1 Samuel 11 and 12, but that whole cover-up that he tries to utilize to hide the fact that he cheated with somebody else's wife. He lies. He tries to get a man drunk. He has a man murdered because he didn't like the fact that he might get caught fathering a child with another man's wife. He transformed into something we would never have expected. That's what I call the Hulk test. When you're under stress, when things are not going well, are you still the same person that you have always been? For a Christian, I think that's a critical kind of thing. This is taken from the world of computing, the WYSIWYG test. Now, some of you who may be older and remember the early days of computing, WYSIWYG is an acronym that means what you see is what you get. I remember old computers. And sometimes you're looking at a document that you have created on the screen, and then you print it out, and the printed document looked nothing like the document on the screen. The margins are all different. The colors are all different. The shading is all different. What looked like a cool piece of clip art on the screen looks like junk on your paper. And in the early days of desktop computing, and particularly the early days of like graphics and that kind of thing, desktop publishing, a lot of software companies started advertising and people that made monitors. This is a WYSIWYG monitor. This is a WYSIWYG application. What you see on the screen, that's exactly what it's going to look like on the paper when you actually print it out. And I'm sure even now with all of the good computing stuff we have, every now and then you create something at your desktop and you project it on the screen like I did earlier with all my fonts messed up. On my desktop, it looked great. So what you see is what you get. That's what that acronym means. What it means in terms of integrity is this. You're the same person in public that you are in private. You don't have a public persona and then a private persona. There's an instance of this over in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. We talked about 2 Corinthians many times. 2 Corinthians is Paul's, essentially, it's his defense of his apostleship. Somewhere between the time when he left Corinth and he wrote 1 Corinthians and now he's headed back to try to mend fences with them, somewhere in that time period, apparently some people moved into Corinth that started really bad-mouthing Paul. Or if they didn't move in, there suddenly arose an element in the congregation where they are seriously questioning Paul's integrity. Is Paul really an apostle? Or if he is an apostle, is he a good apostle? Is this guy worth listening to? And they're attacking him in every conceivable way. They're really basically questioning whether or not he ought to be categorized as an apostle. But it's interesting in chapter 10, 2 Corinthians 10. I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. Now, he's going to pick up on that theme a little bit later in the book, in chapter 13. He's going to remind, meekness is that quality of self-restraint. And he's emphasizing here, I am being very restrained with how I'm treating you. Later in the book, as he closes out the book in chapter 13, one of the things he's going to say is, when I come, I'm not going to be so meek. When I come, if I have to wave the big stick of authority, I'll do that. But he's appealing to them on the basis of meekness. By the meekness and gentleness of Christ. And then he says, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold toward you when I am away. They've accused him of being two different people. They're saying, Paul, with you, well, you're this way around us, and then you write these letters, and these letters are nasty, and they're mean, and they're angry, and they're hurtful. You got two different Pauls here. With Paul, what you see is not what you get, is what they were claiming. But I think that's a significant point. Are you the same in public as you are in private? That's a matter of integrity. Now, in private, you may be this seething, angry, hostile person, and then suddenly in public, oh, it's so good to see you. Or in private, you may be given to lust, whereas in public, you're squeaky clean. Maybe in private, you just roll things over in your mind and you get bitter and you start thinking about vengeful thoughts and things like that. But in public, you're just syrupy sweet. What are you in private versus what you are in public? With you and your character and your personality, is it what you see is what you get, or is it something else? I believe it's a matter of moral consistency, that what we are in public is the same as what we are in private. That's test number two. Then there's the Rome test. You've heard the expression, when in Rome, do as the Romans. And what that test implies is sort of an extension of the second one. Are you the same with this group of people that you are with that group of people? And there are people who are Christians, and when they're around their Christian friends, when they're around their fellow Christians, when they're at church, when they're in small groups, when they're at potlucks, they are just as nice as they can be. But then you put them with other companions, and it becomes a totally, totally different thing. Suddenly they get very worldly. Suddenly, they start telling jokes they shouldn't be telling. Suddenly, they start using language they shouldn't be using. Suddenly, they will watch anything and everything that they would object to in any other setting. And there's actually a biblical example of this in the book of Galatians. In Galatians chapter 2, again, Paul is defending his apostleship. And one of the things that he brings up is in chapter 2, verses 11 through 14. And he talks about an incident where he withstood Peter to his face. And the point of the illustration is not to badmouth Peter. It's not to make Peter look bad. It's the point that Paul is making, that I had enough confidence as an apostle. I had the authority as an apostle to rebuke a fellow apostle, and one with the status, the stature that Peter had. And here's the occasion. He says in Galatians chapter 2, verse 11, when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? The particular issue is that Peter was sitting down to eat with Gentiles. And maybe he was even eating foods that as a Jew he might have considered unclean, but he's in the presence of Gentiles. He realized it was not an issue for him. But suddenly some Jewish people come along from Jerusalem, and they start saying, wait a minute, what are you doing associating with these Gentiles? And suddenly, Peter changes his behavior because of the crowd that has influenced him. And what's remarkable is, in this case, these are Christians who are acting unbecomingly. These are Christians who are drawing artificial lines. So whether you live this way around this group of Christians and this way around a different group of Christians, or whether you're living this way around Christians and this way around worldly people, it's inconsistent. And it becomes a matter of integrity. Do you have the integrity to live the same way, to have the same beliefs, to practice the same things regardless of who you're with. If you believe that this is morally wrong, are you going to say it's morally wrong in every single kind of circumstance? That's what integrity requires. Integrity requires that you're the same person no matter who you are with. Another test, I call it the initiation test. Are you the first one to do the right thing, or are you the last one? Do you always wait for somebody else to do the right thing and then you'll just kind of get on board with it if you see enough people doing it? I believe that if you're sincerely concerned about doing the right thing, you ought to be an initiator. You ought to be the first person on the bandwagon, so to speak. There's an old story that comes from the ancient Olympics. The Olympic Games were going on, and they're in this huge amphitheater like they had in ancient Greece. And this old man comes in. He's kind of staggering down the steps. He's very feeble. He's trying to find a seat. He goes over here. There's no seating. Goes over there. There's no seating. There's a group of Athenians over here. Now, Athenians were they were philosophers. They always talked about doing what was right. They philosophized about doing what was right constantly. And over here are the Spartans. He tried to sit down among the Athenians, and they all just laughed at him. They poked fun at him because he's this feeble old man trying to find a seat. He wanders over to the side where the Spartans are sitting. Every one of them stood up at once and moved away so that this man could sit. And someone who was observing him said, observing this, the Athenians admire what is right. The Spartans do what is right. Do you admire what's right, or do you do what's right? Do you take the initiative in doing things, or do you simply wait around and if enough other people do it, then suddenly you're all for it? The Bible speaks about this over in Romans. Romans chapter 12, the whole chapter is just very loaded with all kinds of practical things that we need to be doing as Christians. Most of chapter 12 is dealing how we treat one another in the body of Christ. And as you get down toward the end of the chapter, Romans chapter 12, I want to start reading in verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. A lot of very practical advice about relationships, especially stressful relationships. Especially in those relationships where things are being done to you that you know are wrong. What do you do when people mistreat you? And in the middle of this text, look at verse 17 and 18. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. And particularly verse 18, this is the initiation test. You take the initiative. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. So far as it depends on you. In other words, you take the first action. You take the initiative in doing what's right. Don't wait around for somebody else to do it. And I think what he's particularly addressing here is, don't wait to see how the other person is going to treat you. Well, we'll just see how this unfolds. Well, if they treat me right, then I'm going to treat them a certain way. No, Paul said no. If it depends on you, you act as if that relationship depends on you, and you take the initiative, and you do the right thing. And you do it first. Imagine what it would be like if Christians just tripped all over themselves trying to be the first to do something good to their fellow Christians. Far too often, we're just waiting for somebody else to, or we're waiting to see how the other person treats us. And that's not how Christians ought to be. Christians ought to be taking the initiative to things. Rather than reacting, we take the initiative. We cause the chain reaction, so to speak. So that's the initiation test. Test number 5 is the resistance test. How much resistance do you put up with, in doing what's right? Do you do right only when you are forced to do what is right? Do you tell the truth only when you're boxed into a corner and you have to tell the truth and you've been pretty much exposed? Or do you say, well, I'm going to do the right thing, well, because it's the right thing? You don't have to be asked, you don't have to be forced, you don't have to be humiliated. I want us to go back to Genesis 20. This is the story I read from Genesis 20 a little bit earlier. I think Abraham is guilty of this, of failing to do this. He did right when he finally got exposed. Genesis chapter 20, from there Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. And I want to stop there. Now, look, Abraham is the father of the faithful, but he had his moments, folks. There were times when he did not act with integrity, and this is one of them. I mean, put this in a modern perspective. Suppose you're traveling to a foreign country, and you've heard that if the locals find out that you're married and you have a beautiful wife, they may try to kill you. And so what you do is, as you're going on this trip, you say, "Hun, I'm kind of worried about our safety, so let's just do this. Let's pretend like we're not married." How many of your wives would think that? "Oh, that's a brilliant idea. That's a great idea. Thank you for your courage and your bravery. Thanks for standing up for me." No, that's a terrible idea. And that's exactly what Abraham did. "Let's just pretend you're my sister. That way I'll be safe." And Abimelech sent and took Sarah, and we read this earlier, verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said, "Behold, you're a dead man." And Abimelech protests. He said, "Will you kill an innocent people? They said that she and he are brother and sister." And then he protests in verse 5, "In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands I have done this." God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you will surely die, you and all who are yours." And so Abimelech rose early in the morning and called his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. And then Abimelech called Abraham and said, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." In this case, Abimelech was right and Abraham was wrong. You shouldn't treat others this way. And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" And Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do to me at every place to which we come. Say of me, he is my brother.'" When he's boxed into a corner and he knows he's been exposed, Abraham admits that he lied. We had a rule with our kids that, you know, sometimes you get in trouble at school. Sometimes you may not do the right thing in school. But I want to hear it from you before I hear it from the principal. Because if I hear it from the principal or the teacher or somebody else first, oh, it gets bad, and it gets bad fast. And occasionally they put our philosophy to the test. And they found out that we weren't playing. Our son did it more than the girls did, I'll say that, but anyway. But yeah, I want to know from you, did you do what was wrong? I want to know that. Now, I realize that maybe not everything is the kind of thing that we should openly confess. There are private things, and maybe we need to confess it to an individual. There may be things that only we know about. We pray to God about that. I get that distinction. But when your failure involves other people, when you have wronged someone else, they need to hear it from you. They need to hear it from you and not from some third party. It needs to be clear that you have wronged them, and you need to own that. That's a matter, I believe, of integrity. Do you resist doing the right thing, or do you do the right thing the first time? Do you do the right thing because you know it's right? Then there is the discovery test, sort of like what we were just talking about. Do you self-correct? 2 Corinthians chapter 13, I think this is the point that Paul is making there. The brethren in Corinth have accused Paul of all kinds of bad things. And Paul finally just pretty much ends the letter with a very simple question for them. Verse 5, 2 Corinthians 13, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Or do you not realize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail to meet the test? I hope you will find out that we have not failed the test, but we pray to God that you may not do wrong. He says, I'm coming there. And when I come, all of these threats, all of these things I have told you, they will come to pass. And I will deal with the problems. I want to deal with it as gently as possible. But if you have not examined yourself, you're not going to be ready for this. Do you examine yourself? Do you self-correct? When you realize that you've done something wrong, do you take care of it? Again, that kind of goes back to the previous point as well, a little bit of overlap there. Are you willing to own up to your failures? And that requires a great deal of honesty. The Psalms talk a lot about this. Over in Psalm 19, the psalmist frequently prays that God will expose any sins that are in his life. Psalm number 19. He talks in verses 7 through 11 about the Word of God, which is witness to the nature of God. He talks about all the qualities of the law of God. And he says in verse 11, moreover, by them your servant is warned, in keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins, and let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. He's praying for integrity. He's praying that if there is anything wrong inside of him, if there is something lurking about in his heart, he wants to correct it, and he wants God to help him correct that. He is willing to open up his life to God, examine it in the light of the Word of God that he's just described in the previous verses. He says, I want to know if I'm right or not. I want to know if I'm right with you. I want to know if I'm right with others. At the end of Psalm 139, you have a similar kind of plea. Psalm 139, he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. God, search me, examine me, help me examine myself. That is at the heart of integrity, a willingness to own up to our faults. And finally, the word test. Do you keep your word? Do you keep your word? It is so easy to promise, well, as I heard it said one time, you promise the moon and you deliver a box of rocks. You ever done that? Oh, I'm going to do this. And it's going to be the nicest thing you ever saw. And then you kind of sort of halfway do it, not really. Do you keep your word? Do you keep your word? Go back to Psalm 15. This was one of the texts that we read earlier. You know, Psalm 15 verse 2 uses that word for integrity. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right. But a little bit later on, there's a couple of things that are said about this man described in Psalm number 15. Psalm number 15, the man is the one in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. Second part of verse 4, he swears to his own hurt and does not change. He gives his word and he keeps it, and it doesn't matter what it costs him. A lot of times we give our word, we make a promise, and then we realize, oh, that's going to cost me a lot. That's going to cost me a lot of money. That's going to cost me a lot of time. That's going to cost me a lot of inconvenience. Maybe I should have thought about that. Yeah, maybe you should have, but in the meantime, what do? You keep your word. I think in a sense, you're keeping your word may be the last fence between you and failure. If you're not willing to keep your word, what is left? What is left? What's left of our integrity if we're not willing to do what we say? People of God are people of truth. And again, I think it's significant that the word integrity is related to a lot of biblical words for truth. Are you a person of truth? Do you keep your word? Do you do what you say? So those are my seven tests of integrity. The Bible encourages us to be people of integrity, people of sincerity, people of unfeigned character. You're not a fake. You're the real thing. I want to go back to that illustration I started with Eric Liddell. He was on hands at the finals of the 100-meter dash. Now, remember, the preliminary round was on a Sunday, and he didn't believe he could go. The actual 100-meter dash, the gold medal round, was on a different day of the week, and so he went to it. He was in the stands, and he watched them in the 1924 Olympics. That was the race he was expected to win. And as he was sitting there, somebody asked him near the beginning of the race, "So do you have any regrets?" And Liddell's comment was, "Regrets, yes. Doubts, no." That's integrity. That's integrity. There are a lot of regrets in life. There are a lot of things that we wish might be different. But the question is, have you done the right thing? Do you always do the right thing? Do you take initiative in doing the right thing? Are you always the same kind of person, regardless of your circumstances, regardless of the crowd? Are you the same kind of person inside and out? That's integrity. And that's something that I believe ultimately comes to us by the strength of God. We have the ultimate example of integrity. There's a lot of people in the Bible who exhibited great integrity in their lives, but I'll tell you, the ultimate example is Jesus of Nazareth. He was always the same. Inside and out, public and private, he always did the right thing. He always said the right thing. He always followed through on his word. Jesus is the model of integrity. And as those two psalms that we read, Psalm 19 at the end and Psalm 139, as those psalms remind us, God helps us with that as we turn our lives over to him and ask him to examine us. So if you examine your life, what do you see? Are you a person of integrity or not? Now, if you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, that's not possible. You can never be the person that you're capable of being apart from Jesus Christ. And for those of us that are Christians, sometimes we forget what integrity is and we start acting more like the world and less like the people of God. Whatever your need is, we want to help you with that this morning while we stand and sing.